Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Liv Little, l'animatrice de Why I Move, s'est associée à elle et Nike pour proposer un podcast qui va vous redonner le pouvoir, vous motiver et toutes nous maintenir en mouvement. Liv discutera avec certaines de ses personnalités préférées issues du monde de la mode, de la culture et du sport pour découvrir ce qui les fait bouger et pourquoi. Vous entendrez également les entraîneurs et formateurs Nike qui viendront valider les conseils donnés. Alors, faites une pause, inspirez profondément et écoutez Why I Move. Vous êtes prêtes ?
In 1969, a plan to show support for an anti-racism protest turned the lives of 14 promising black student athletes upside down. Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 18th of February, these are our main stories. The whereabouts of the body of the late Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny remain unknown. The Russian authorities are refusing to release it to his family. The US President Joe Biden has blamed congressional inaction for Ukraine's defeat in the frontline town of Avdiivka during a phone call with President Zelensky. Benjamin Netanyahu has insisted he won't bow to international pressure over Israel's offensive in Gaza. Also in this podcast...
A long time ago in a flat in West London.
The discarded Star Wars memorabilia feeling the force of the auctioneer's gavel. Russia has seen its biggest political protests for more than a year. Reaction to the death announced on Friday of Vladimir Putin's most formidable opponent, Alexei Navalny. An independent monitoring group says around 350 people have now been detained in cities across Russia as mourners brought flowers to lay at impromptu memorials. On Saturday, some of Mr. Navalny's supporters went out onto the streets of Moscow.
This is very sad for us all. But Alexei said not to give up, and we won't give up, and let them think that they have won. That's not true. History, truth and goodness are on our side. We will definitely win.
The main thing is truth. Truth to power.
We only live once. Moreover, if we don't come out now, then when? Now we may be detained and then released, but later we may not be released. We are not Belarus yet, so we can still go out. We can still speak our opinion, at least some.
Well, on Saturday, Mr. Navalny's mother and lawyer reached the morgue near the remote Arctic prison where he died on Friday, but were told it did not have his body. The authorities then said the family wouldn't receive the remains until a post-mortem was complete. But Kira Yarmish, a spokesperson for the Navalny family, says his body is purposely being withheld by the Russian government, adding she had no doubt he'd been murdered.
What is happening right now is that they are trying to cover traces. This is why they are not giving the body to his family, and this is why they are just hiding him from them.
I spoke to the BBC's Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, and asked her for more on the protests. They may not have been huge, but a way for those people to mark this moment?
Although the way that they have marked this moment is also telling in itself. So instead of people pouring onto the streets in angry protest and shouting political slogans, what they did was they began carrying flowers and other tributes to monuments to political repression from Stalin's time around Russia. So those were the sites that were chosen. Obviously, huge political symbolism in the decision to use monuments from historic political repression to mark the death of Alexei Navalny, who, of course, was imprisoned because of his politics and has died in that prison. So those protests have been rather more acts of remembrance, but in themselves they are acts of defiance because, of course, in Russia today it is extremely difficult to protest and it is extremely easy to be arrested whilst making any kind of political statement. So we've seen people who've even stood next to those heaps of flowers with signs saying, for example, we won't forgive and we won't forget, those kinds of slogans, those people then getting dragged away by by police through the snow. So some 300 or so people, I think, have been detained so far, and they'll probably face fines or short periods in police custody.
Meanwhile, Sarah, a lot of people are deeply suspicious about why the authorities are not releasing the body. What do we know about what Russia is saying about an investigation into the death?
Very little, and obviously a huge lack of trust from Navalny's family, his lawyer, his supporters towards the Russian state, which is absolutely understandable given that this is a man who was poisoned with a nerve agent just 3 years ago. So they don't trust a single word that comes to the authorities, and at the moment the authorities are actually saying very little. But what is absolute fact is that they don't yet have a body. So the investigative committee, a powerful body, is saying that the body of Alexei Navalny will be released once they've finished their work. But the family, so his mother, is basically moving around towns in the Arctic trying to find the body of her son to at least discover where exactly it's located. Because, of course, the family and Mr. Navalny's supporters want to know for themselves exactly why and how he died, and they won't believe the official investigation or report.
So the authorities not saying much about Mr. Navalny's body, not saying much at all, despite a deluge of criticism from around the world, from Joe Biden downwards.
No, saying very, very little. Vladimir Putin, of course, appeared for a kind of pre-planned event at a factory, but he said absolutely nothing at all. He very, very rarely referred to Alexei Navalny when he was alive. He never referred to him by name. That was deliberate. And I think, you know, we'll wait and see. But for now, absolutely no comment from the Kremlin, apart from to say that the comments from world leaders have been unacceptable.
Sarah Rainsford. President Biden has blamed the US Congress for the fall of the Ukrainian town of Avdiivka to Russian forces. In a telephone call with President Zelensky, Mr. Biden said inaction by Washington had left Ukraine's troops without enough ammunition. From Washington, Will Vernon reports.
In a phone call with President Zelensky, Joe Biden emphasized the need for the US Congress to urgently pass legislation to grant more military aid to Ukraine. It was congressional inaction, said the White House statement, that led to the Ukrainian army's withdrawal from Avdiivka due to a shortage of supplies and ammunition. In recent months, Republican lawmakers have repeatedly failed to approve $60 billion of desperately needed funds for Kyiv. Speaking in Munich, the American Vice President, Kamala Harris, said Washington couldn't play political games with the issue of support for Ukraine.
Politics should play no role and standing for the fact that Vladimir Putin, through his leadership of Russia, has shown himself to be fundamentally hostile to democratic principles.
Mr. Zelensky expressed gratitude for Mr. Biden's backing, adding, "I believe the US Congress will make a wise decision."
Well, earlier, President Zelensky said that his troops had been heavily outnumbered by the Russians at Avdiivka and had withdrawn to save lives. I spoke to our correspondent in Kyiv, James Wardhouse, about the latest Russian military success.
Avdiivka poses a lot of difficult questions, mostly for Ukraine, in that the fear is that it could be the first of many. And I think Avdiivka is symptomatic of this war of attrition that this invasion has now become, where you have both sides trying to exhaust each other. But crucially, Russia can remain on a war footing. So you have President Zelensky, who can say with quite a lot of confidence in Munich to other world leaders, this, the wording he used was, this artificial shortfall in weaponry and ammunition is causing Russia to advance in this way. What he's implying is that this is a choice, and that only if those supplies are replenished or restored to the levels they once were, can Ukraine take back control of more of its territory.
What are the next areas that could be vulnerable to Russia's expansion here?
It's best to imagine this eastern flank of the front line like a beach, where you have Russia making a huge push in the northeast towards the city of Kupiansk. But now they have Avdiivka. They've also been pummeling this small town of Pokrovsk, which I was there about 6 months ago, which is the hub for soldiers. The hotel we stayed in was subsequently destroyed by a missile. The only restaurant that we ate there was destroyed by a missile. It is firmly in Russia's sights. So it'll be interesting to see whether the Russians stop there or whether they are indeed able to push further ahead. But crucially, what we're not talking about here is Ukrainian liberation. And I think that is now widely accepted, that any hope of Ukraine repelling Russia completely, that couldn't be more on the back burner. By the admission of its own generals, It's on a defensive footing. It is in holding on mode while President Zelensky tries to find some kind of political solution.
Ukraine says it's outgunned in many areas of the country by Russia. To what extent could the $60 billion US dollars that are held up in Washington at the moment help redress that imbalance?
Well, it would significantly. I mean, if we look at the last package of that size, I remember it. I remember after Ukraine's extraordinary defence of Kyiv, it was only once a similar package arrived from the US that it could start to prepare for more. It was in a position to at least attempt a huge counteroffensive in 2023. When you're talking about a package worth tens of billions of dollars, that means longer-range missiles. That means artillery shells to a huge extent. And the reason it's going to keep coming back to the US. It is the US and the US alone which leads the way on weaponry. And as long as this disagreement goes on, then the pressure will mount on Kyiv to make some kind of territorial concession. But what does Kyiv say to that every time? Vladimir Putin won't stop here, no matter what he signs by way of a ceasefire or longer-term peace agreement.
James Waterhouse. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to carry on the war against Hamas, regardless of international pressure. He insisted victory was within sight. Here's Mike Thompson.
In the face of unprecedented international pressure, some from Israel's biggest ally, the US, Mr. Netanyahu said the planned offensive on Gaza's southernmost city, Rafah, would go ahead. To stop now, he insisted, would hand victory to Hamas. 1.5 million civilians are sheltering there. A Palestinian state, Mr. Netanyahu reiterated, was out of the question, as were peace talks, given what he called Hamas's delusional demands. Some might use the same word to describe the beleaguered Prime Minister's claim that Israel is largely united behind his policies.
Mike Thompson. Scientists in Italy and the USA have been researching whether playing table tennis may help people with neurological conditions like multiple sclerosis. The partnership came about because of one Italian doctor who's practicing in the US. Antonino Barbera has been telling Rebecca Kesby how he himself was diagnosed with MS and discovered that table tennis, sometimes called ping pong, relieved his symptoms.
I started feeling like a boiling oil just sitting on my right hip, and I had no idea what to do. I started almost crying. I mean, this pain was unbearable. And Friday, I did an MRI of my brain, and it was like a Christmas tree. So the MRI of my brain generally looks gray, and we had so many light bulbs. I mean, those are the plaques of multiple sclerosis.
I mean, you're a medical doctor, you're an obstetrician and gynecologist, very sort of high-flying career. You must have been devastated by that.
Well, I was indeed, because during the first clinical assessment that he made, I kept asking, do I have MS? And he was looking at me and he was answering, yes, you do.
So you did realise that by playing ping pong, of all things, that seemed to help your symptoms. How did you work that out?
One of my discomfort that became a painful sensation for a while is a sense of constriction on my chest. I mean, 24 hours a day. In the world of medicine, this thing is referred as the MS hug, and people do not know what to do. And so I was playing a little bit of ping pong in the garage with my son. I felt something strange. After a couple of days, a week of playing, I realized that this sensation was disappearing. Well, I call this the elephant sitting on my chest. This elephant is really leaving my chest and sitting on the corner in the chair. Oh my gosh, how can that be possible?
But what do you think it is about ping pong that has that effect?
It's a fast game. If we challenge our brain, there is a specific area in our brain called hippocampus that generates new cells. This process is called neurogenesis. Now, what these cells do eventually, they create new connections, new nerve pathway. Well, think about that. I mean, I was lucky enough to recover from my two attacks because my body was able eventually to create new myelin, that is this protective layer that goes around the nerves. Why other people do not?
So you think it is because it's such a fast game that your brain, your hand-eye coordination is having to happen much faster than in other sports?
Yes, it's the number of things that happen at once in a very short time. So there is an increase of vascularization to a specific area of your brain. There are different senses that need to be activated and they need to work together. But on top of that, you need to move as well. You need also to relax because you don't have time to get stressed because the ball is coming back at you. Mm. So in any physical activity, there is always this stressful component of learning and being stressed and the hedonistic component as well. So increasing the pleasure of this physical activity really indeed produce a joyful activity.
And so you were able to push for this to be looked into and get other scientists on board to do some real research into this.
So I trained myself. I read as much as I could. But I said, well, I want to surround myself by experts. And I said, OK, let me propose this project to people. And we put up together scientific protocols to see if indeed our intervention means this activity based on table tennis may indeed improve the total quality of life of these people. At the beginning, I noticed immediately that especially people with Parkinson and multiple sclerosis, they were improving in front of my face.
Wow.
Their balance was improving. Their mood was improving. Their coordination was improving. Their stiffness was improving. I mean, they were coming smiling and leaving smiling. And also we were building this sense of community. So I told myself, okay, guys, we need to prove this.
Antonino Barbera there. And the research is being expanded and may also include dementia. Still to come.
People, they need something that's for them just to concentrate on. It doesn't matter what you make, however hideous it is.
Part of an 8-minute film about the world of knitting that's been nominated for Best Short Animation at today's British Academy Film Awards in London.
Remarkable personal stories.
Betrayal. It runs through my life and runs through my story.
Deep dive documentaries.
These children are using their own bags, not to carry books, but they carry the drug markets in Sweden on their shoulders.
And sport, but not as you know it.
There's this massive landslide of myth, and somewhere in there is the truth.
The BBC World Service tells the world's stories. Search for Lives Less Ordinary, The Documentary, and Amazing Sports Stories, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Liv Little, l'animatrice de Why I Move, s'est associée à elle et Nike pour proposer un podcast qui va vous redonner le pouvoir, vous motiver et toutes nous maintenir en mouvement. Liv discutera avec certaines de ses personnalités préférées, issues du monde de la mode, de la culture et du sport, pour découvrir ce qui les fait bouger et pourquoi. Vous entendrez également les entraîneurs et formateurs Nike qui viendront valider les conseils donnés. Alors, faites une pause, inspirez profondément et écoutez Why I Move. Vous êtes prête?
Now, back to the Global News podcast. Next to Hungary, where the Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, has promised a package of new child protection measures. That's after a week of high-profile resignations and a mass protest over a child sexual abuse scandal. He made the announcement on Saturday in his State of the Nation speech.
A magyar gyermekvédelmi rendszert meg kell erősíteni.
The Hungarian child protection system must be strengthened. The suffering of the victims means we must do this. We must strengthen the leadership of the child protection institutions and their supervision and the rules about who can work there. We will have to table all these together to Parliament in the form of a new child protection law.
Well, on Friday, tens of thousands of people had taken to the streets to highlight the scandal which led to the resignation of Mr. Orban's close ally, the President, Katalin Novak, and two others. I asked our Hungary correspondent Nick Thorpe on a slightly wobbly telephone line, why were the people so angry that they took to the streets?
This is a scandal about the granting of clemency by President Katalin Novak to the deputy head of an orphanage. He had been sentenced to prison for covering up the crimes, the sexual crimes against children of his director, the head of the orphanage. It turned out earlier this month that the clemency decision had been made, and obviously this was very, very controversial for a government. This caused a lot of confusion among government voters, and of course it led to these very high-level resignations. So it was very bad. As the Prime Minister himself said, this was a nightmarish start to the year for him and his government.
And Nick, do you think what Mr. Orban said today has done enough to draw a line under this politically?
That's his intention very much. It's been very embarrassing for him, this case. He said that though he'd lost two very good people, the two women in particular who'd resigned, the president and the former minister of justice, that their decision was a right one. He says he wants to move beyond this, firstly with those resignations, next with this package of far-reaching child protection laws, and thirdly with an amendment to the constitution and a new president. The opposition, of course, 4 months ahead of June elections, local and European elections, they want to keep this issue going. They want to keep it in the public eye. They say there are lots of questions that haven't been answered. And also there have been revelations or other allegations since the resignations of high-level government corruption. So a lot of things have sort of been thrown into the public eye by this.
Nick Thorpe. One of Pakistan's top government officials has been arrested after saying the election results last week were manipulated. He's taken full responsibility and says he should be punished. The Election Commissioner of Pakistan has strongly rejected his claims. Caroline Davis reports from Islamabad.
It's incredibly unusual for a Pakistan civil servant to make this statement. The Rawalpindi Commissioner, Liaquat Ali Chatta, appeared at a press conference saying that he was resigning from his post and has handed himself over to the police. He accepted responsibility for rigging the election. Pakistan's Electoral Commission has said that the civil servant didn't have direct responsibilities for the election and rejected Mr. Chatta's claims. There has been no instruction to rig the vote, they insisted. Pakistan is still waiting for a new government to be formed. Candidates backed by Imran Khan won more seats than anyone else, but not enough for a majority. His party has called on supporters to protest around the country against what it alleges to have been a stolen election.
Caroline Davis. Now, have you ever tried knitting to de-stress after a long day? Well, the textile craft takes centre stage in an 8-minute movie called Visible Mending, which has been nominated for Best Short Animation at Sunday's British Academy Film Awards in London, also known as the BAFTAs. Director Sam Moore wanted to find out if the craft of knitting can bring a sense of calm to people's mental health. Vincent Dowd reports.
They need something that's for them just to concentrate on. It doesn't matter what you make, however hideous it is.
Knitting wool in a bright orange ball rolls into view, and it's picked up in the film by a grey mouse, also made of wool.
There's something about, you know, when your life is sort of falling apart, you need to have create a purpose in it for yourself. And if that purpose is quite small, it doesn't matter. Something tangible.
Director Sam Moore has been working on the BAFTA-nominated film Visible Mending for 6 years. It's in a combination of animated styles with a soundtrack of interview clips with the knitting addicts she tracked down.
When my mum was diagnosed with early onset dementia in her early 60s, I realised the role that knitting had played and was still playing, helping her brain to make sense of the world. And I went and visited lots of knitting groups who I chatted to about what knitting meant to them.
Pete Johnson is a former radio producer. Johnson signed up to record many of the voices, including that of his own wife, Kate.
She used to use knitting not only to construct garments and little creatures and all sorts of things, but also it was an emotional haven for her. She suffered from depression for quite a few years, and she found that knitting a release.
When Kate Johnson realised she was dying of cancer, she asked Sam Moore if she could record extra final thoughts for the film on the importance of knitting to her, even as life ebbed away.
I mean, I have terminal cancer and I am not really on the ball sometimes and my energy levels are really low. That was the thing with me. Although I couldn't do the things I wanted to do, I could still knit and crochet and just little things and think, well, I've done that.
Kate died in 2022. Sam Moore's film crams more human experience into 8 minutes than many films do into 2 hours. To Carmel Duggan, it's a craft classic.
It may get people looking at knitting and craft work in general as a therapeutic thing, which it was always. It gives you problem-solving skills, confidence in your own ability to do things, and there's a great sense of satisfaction at the end of it. It's always therapeutic. always.
Vincent Dowd with that report. A draft script for the original Star Wars film has sold for nearly $11,000 at an auction in London. The incomplete screenplay was left in a London flat rented by the actor Harrison Ford during filming in the 1970s. Adam Gocher reports.
A long time ago, in a flat in West London. Harrison Ford, an actor on the cusp of worldwide fame, accidentally left a draft script behind for a movie he was in. The screenplay features the film's original title, The Adventures of Luke Starkiller. But it became known as Star Wars. Today, in an auction house not so far away, the script was put up for sale, along with a number of other items which the man behind Han Solo left in the flat. Jonathan Tarode from Excalibur Auctions says the actors behind Luke Skywalker and Princess Leia also used to visit the property.
They refer to it as a wonderful summer with Harrison staying with them. They would drink in the garden with him. Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher would come round and see him.
Harrison Ford might have unwittingly handed the flat's owner a lot of precious Star Wars nostalgia, but according to the auction house, the vendor was generally impressed by her tenant. She recalled him being excellent and very tidy.
Adam Gocher reporting there. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. Before we go, I just wanted to apologise that in recent days, because of a technical glitch, some people may not have been able to download the podcast. Apparently, this matter is now being dealt with. This edition was mixed by Dan Ehrlich. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Liv Little, l'animatrice de Why I Move, s'est associée à elle et Nike pour proposer un podcast qui va vous redonner le pouvoir, vous motiver et toutes nous maintenir en mouvement. Liv discutera avec certaines de ses personnalités préférées issues du monde de la mode, de la culture et du sport pour découvrir ce qui les fait bouger et pourquoi. Vous entendrez également les entraîneurs et formateurs Nike qui viendront valider les conseils donnés. Alors, faites une pause, inspirez profondément et écoutez Why I Move. Vous êtes prêtes ?